From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. On this show, we've been talking a lot about Eucharistic miracles these days. These are these occasions where we see perhaps 100 or more times in Christian history some sort of phenomena associated with the Eucharist. And this is a great time to talk about this with the Eucharistic revival of the USCCB, the U.S. bishops, upon us now. And in recent weeks, we've had different conversations about phenomena happening in the Archdiocese of Hartford in Connecticut, the multiplication of hosts, you might say. Also, there was a claim of something coming out of Rhode Island recently as well. We'll talk about that later in the show. But these Eucharistic miracle cases where you have true flesh and true blood manifesting on a Eucharistic host are absolutely mind-blowing. And we're going to be so excited today to be talking with Dr. Franco Sarafini. He is one of the world's experts on Eucharistic miracles coming out of Italy. And he's the author of the book from Sophia Institute Press, A Cardiologist Examines Jesus. And he'll be talking to us today on the fascinating phenomenon of Eucharistic miracles. And later in the show, we'll be talking to Carrie Solomon, the producer, director, and writer of the new film Nefarious, a new film about exorcism. He's the writer and producer, and he's also known for films like Unplanned, God's Not Dead, and Do You Believe? And so this Nefarious film is also very eye-opening. You can check out my show, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, on Saturdays today, Saturday the 20th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. There's a show on Trey Fontana. And so I'll be traveling to investigate a miraculous encounter at the site where St. Paul was martyred in the Virgin of Revelation's appearance to Bruno Canacciola, a rabid anti-Catholic, changed both the man and the church itself. An absolutely fascinating episode. I encourage people to check that one out. You can also look for my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from Tan Books and available at EWTNRC.com. And in that book, I talk about how the angle that the church takes with science and how those aren't incompatible, and the rigorous investigation of miraculous occurrences, including Eucharistic miracles. In today's show, we'll be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project. Today, we've got a Marian feast, Mother of God Zairovici from Belarus in the 14th century. The might-be saint of the day is Blessed Maria Angelica Perez, who lived from 1897 to 1952 from Argentina. And the question of the week is a good one. It's fascinating to me. She says, I am not religious, but I received an apparition of Jesus. What do I do next? I'm going to try to answer that question in just a little bit. Let's take a look at the miracle news. Each week we report on the miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And I always love reporting the big miracle stories, especially things like Eucharistic miracles. Well, it turns out in some cases that it really isn't a miracle at all. There was a miracle, a quote-unquote miracle, being reported in Rhode Island. It was a story of the Eucharist turning blue. People may have seen this bouncing around on Catholic social media this past week. And it was kind of an interesting thing that happened. After this story was first published, Father Giacomo Copaverdi, he published an update on his personal Facebook page. And so it was kind of interesting because before or when the report came out, they talked about this Eucharist and a monstrance was turning blue. And also the monstrance itself had all these icons of saints around the perimeter, and they were turning blue too. And that was, I'm not quite sure why the Eucharist would turn blue and that would be a miracle, but people were pointing to it as something perhaps in the month of May, something a Marian connection. But when I heard that I saw that all the icons were now blue also, that led me to think that there was probably an external factor influencing that. And so the quote from Father Giacomo on his personal Facebook page, he says, every consecration is an actual miracle of ordinary bread and wine changing into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ. We had an event this week here where our host and the monstrance changed color seemingly spontaneously. However, upon time, further investigation, we found a natural explanation. The change was due to a new kind of LED bulb purchased for the chapel, a felt electric enhanced vivid natural light 75 watt. He lists the whole thing. The new spotlight purchase had no indication on the packaging it would cast a blue hue, and the host did not appear blue until 32 hours after changing the light. So that was a light, a blue light shining down on the Eucharistic host, which ended up changing it to that blue color. So, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, not a Eucharistic miracle, just a natural explanation sometime this time. But that's how it is sometimes. So we'll wait for the next Eucharistic miracle to get excited about. You can see that story if you go to the Facebook feed of The Miracle Hunter. You can find out more about what that story started off as and how it ended up. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week, where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that writes in with the fastest with the correct answer. And last week we said this is the month of May, the month of Mary. What is the technical name for the veneration of Mary as opposed to the worship or to the veneration to other saints or the worship given to God? And that fancy term was hyperdulia. The question for this week is, we're talking today with Dr. Franco Serafini, the cardiologist who examined Jesus, according to the title of the book, and absolutely fascinating conversation to come up about Eucharistic miracles. So the question is, the two most recent Eucharistic miracles in the world that have been approved by the Church happened in what country? What is the country that has the very two most recent Eucharistic miracles? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com, and answers and winners will be posted on the show page on ewtn.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, and we're talking with Dr. Franco Serafini, he is one of the world's experts on Eucharistic miracles coming out of Italy. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to The Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. We've talked before on this show about the phenomenon of Eucharistic miracles. Perhaps as many times as 100 in Christian history, we have various types of Eucharistic miracles, miracles involving the saints, preservations of the Eucharist in a remarkable way, a protection from danger. But the type of Eucharistic miracle that I find most compelling, the most interesting, are these very rare cases where we have true flesh and true blood made manifest on a consecrated Eucharistic host and tested by science, and the results are absolutely startling. And we're so excited today because we have one of the world's top experts on Eucharistic miracles joining us all the way from Bologna in Italy, and his name is Dr. Franco Serafini, and he wrote the book, A Cardiologist Examines Jesus, out from Sophia Institute Press. Welcome to the program today, Dr. Serafini.
Yes. Hello, Michael, and thank you for inviting me to be your guest, and hello to all the listeners.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful that you're here to talk to us today about Eucharistic miracles, and I think it's really interesting to find out how you got interested in this topic. But first, please briefly talk about your background as a cardiologist.
Oh, well, I am... I'm a medical doctor, and I have studied. I'm Italian, and I've studied at the University of Bologna, where I live. And now I work in a public hospital here in Bologna. I'm busy with my work on the ward, work also for outpatients. Well, I have no special academic qualifications. I'm a very normal cardiologist. My job is strictly focused on patients and not in research. So you won't find my name on PubMed with excellences and so on.
Well, wonderful. You're exactly the type of person, however, that we'd love to talk to, somebody who's seen it all when it comes to dealing. We're treating patients, and so. One of the things that is interesting is your knowledge of the heart, of course, is tremendous. But what was it about Eucharistic miracles that first drew your attention? And what do you find most compelling about them?
Well, I have to say that what attracted my attention 7-8 years ago was the fact I knew that there were recent Eucharistic miracles and also ancient Eucharistic miracles that had been scientifically studied, and it seemed to me something very big, something enormous, so something so important. And because I thought if Eucharistic miracles are authentic, and now I know that they are authentic, and it means that we can have information about the body, the health, the DNA of the most important man that lived on this earth, and perhaps what those miracles want to tell us if we study them with forensic examination. But so I was wondering about this, but 7-8 years ago, I couldn't find any dossier available, and nothing on internet. There were no serious book published about this subject. So I decided to interest myself about this very subject, and I started to search and collect all the data available in Poland, in South America, in Mexico, and also in Italy. And I also went personally to those places to know the people involved in Eucharistic miracles, to know the experts that made the examinations. And in fact, I needed to be convinced myself before talk and write and about it. But what I think is compelling in the subject is the fact that there is a pattern that repeats itself in every Eucharistic miracle. You know, if you read my book, you know there is a pattern of suffering heart. There is blood. There is the same blood type. The same strange behavior of DNA, and this repeats itself in different places, in different times, and in this I see a proof of authenticity, of how can I say, of intrinsic consistency, because if the Eucharistic miracles were fakes, how could two different forgers accord themselves in preparing the same thing so elsewhere in the world?
Absolutely. And just to restate for the audience, we talk about this compelling correspondence between samples from different times and different places in Christian history, where these samples come from the same blood group, or they have similar heart tissue or tortured yes. heart muscle, you might say. And that's consistent across the board. And that's the correspondence there is pretty remarkable. Now, one of the most famous cases in history is in Lanciano, perhaps the first known Eucharistic miracle of this type. Yeah. And we have perhaps sometime in the 700s, we have a monk who has a conversion when he has an experience of the bread and wine turning into true flesh and true blood. And tests were done on this by Professor Linoli some decades ago. And it's quite startling to see what he discovered. We find that it is true flesh, as pointed out by Professor Linoli. But this was perhaps 50 years ago now these tests were done. And so the question for you, does the science there in Lanciano still hold up to modern standards? And if you were to do it today, what would you do differently?
Well, in fact, Professor Linoli examined two samples from the flesh, from the blood, the Lanciano relic, and it was in 1970-71, so more than 50 years ago. He used the best techniques available at that time, and those techniques, I think, maintain today the same scientific value. Of course, today we would perform other tests that weren't available at the time. I mean, immunofluorescence, electron microscopy. Now we would do genetics. But I think that the essential, I mean, the fact that there is a human heart, a human blood, AB blood type, well, this was obtained in 1917, and this is... this maintain absolutely strong scientific evidence. Perhaps if we could repeat today techniques available today, would we found something new? Probably yes, because I see that Eucharistic miracles they have always something new to say if we test them. There is an abundance of meaning because, in fact, these tissues talk to us about the Eucharist that is full of meaning in itself. And so, well, I'm sure in future we will have more and more data on old and also new events. And we will see. I think we won't annoy in this subject.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Dr. Franco Serafini from Bologna, a cardiologist who's written the book A Cardiologist Examines Jesus from Sophia Institute Press, one of the world's top experts on Eucharistic miracles. And I was recently, a week or so ago, I was in Poland. I was at Legnica and Sokolka, the sites of the two most recent Eucharistic miracles. And of course, you've been there and you've talked to the experts yourself. And one of the fascinating aspects about the case in Sokolka and also about the 21st century case in Tichla, Mexico, we can see the integration of the bread and the flesh under the microscope. Can you please explain why this proves that this cannot be a hoax if it's configured in this way?
I would say simply because this is a characteristic that No forger can mimic. If we would like to make a hoax, we would simply put a piece of meat on top of a piece of bread. But in Sokolka, Professor Maria Zbieta Sobanić-Lutowska, a very good anatomical a pathologist, she wrote and she tells that the intertwining between the visible bread and the new biological human tissue that has appeared as a miracle, this intertwining is at a sub-microscopic level. And she says that no known science could obtain this deep interpenetration. It's funny. She says that even the she names the NASA, the NASA, the American Space yes. Agency. She says even they couldn't replicate this phenomenon.
Sure.
And also you said rightly in Tixla, Mexico, we have an image that is also it is published in my book too, and we see in this image the structure of the bread. It is like a sponge, not colored, and in the cavities of this sponge that is the bread, we have human cells, single white blood cells, adipocytes, and so on, and it is a very strong image, very, very convincing.
Absolutely. I think that is one of the most remarkable aspects of Eucharistic miracles. There are so many reasons out there to find these cases to be remarkable. Now, one thing that I get asked quite a bit, because we talk about the blood type from blood group AB, and we talk about perhaps every Eucharistic miracle sample around the world that has been able to have the blood type be determined, it's AB. We talk about the Shroud of Turin, it's also blood type AB, and you might say this is a very rare blood type except amongst Middle Eastern men, so it's very, very, very interesting aspect. And so one question, people say, well, that's wonderful that the case in Mexico matches the case in Poland, matches the case in Buenos Aires for blood type. But what about DNA? Why has there not been DNA ever extracted from these samples and compared these different sites around the world?
Well, in fact, the analysis of DNA is so important in forensic medicine today that in modern studies of Eucharistic miracles, you always try to obtain DNA. Of course, this is of paramount importance because you understand that you could identify with very, very strong evidence that those tissues coming, for example, from different Eucharistic miracles or from the Shroud of Turin could belong to the same person. This data would be sensational and prove the authenticity of those miracles and even the absolute reality of the Catholic Eucharist. And so they tried several times. I mean, one in Buenos Aires, twice in Tixla, and once in Legnica in Poland, to sequence some DNA from those tissues.
Yes.
And in fact, there are cells with nucleus, and there is DNA. But then when the genetic laboratories try to do what they do normally, I mean, PCR and then sequence some STR, we call STR short tandem repeats, in order to obtain a personal profile, and the result is always disappointing, and we found no evidence of known sequence. And what does it mean? Why? I don't know why, but because DNA, perhaps, I tried to give some answers, perhaps because DNA is not good quality and not well preserved. But it's true now we can obtain those data from Neanderthal DNA, from Egyptian mummies. So why not from Eucharistic miracles? Perhaps I try to answer myself. It is because it is the DNA of a glorified body, and a body that erases useless repetitions in his DNA, as short tandem repeats are. But in fact, I believe. I came to the conclusion that it's perhaps a miracle in the miracle. I mean, it's as if God wants to hide himself, and he hides himself and wants to protect us from an excess of knowledge that would make useless our faith. Our faith would become redundant if we had the scientific certitude of the presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. And
right.
this must not be, of course. And once again, we see in this aspect of Eucharistic miracle a complexity. Once again, how could a forger obtain this absurd and recurrent phenomenon, the phenomenon of never obtain a DNA CODIS profile? It's interesting, Professor Castagnon, that a Colombian that studied many prodigious events in South America, not only Eucharistic miracles. And he says that when the genetic laboratory gives him a negative answer, they say, oh, Professor, we are sorry. In your samples, there is DNA, but strangely, and we can't obtain sequences. He says that he is happy because he understands that he is on a good track, and it's a very.
He's on the right track there to get to the answer. That's amazing. We're talking today with Dr. Franco Serafini as we wrap up this interview, a fascinating discussion of Eucharistic miracles. I can't help but wonder, what role do you think that the understanding of Eucharistic miracles by the faithful can play a role in evangelization? Why is this so important?
Well, I think they can play a strong role, a strong one, and particularly because the man of our time is so sensitive to science, to technology, and here we have the Eucharist that speaks to us using exactly this language. And In fact, I received many emails from readers of my book that they thank me because this subject gave strength to their faith. But I think that Eucharistic miracles, yes, they can fortify our faith. And in fact, they happen for this. But I don't know, I wouldn't use them as an argument for convince an atheist or because I see Eucharistic miracle is so is something so delicate and I see that Eucharistic miracles never want to exaggerate, to humiliate our faith or our reason. So there is a wonderful equilibrium in this tell us something and in hide something else. So, but it's something very interesting and appassionating. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we're so grateful to you, Dr. Franco Serafini, joining us all the way from Bologna in Italy, and for your great book, A Cardiologist Examines Jesus, out from Sophia Institute Press. Thank you so much for shedding the light on Eucharistic miracles. I think this is such an important thing that people need to be aware of, and you drawing attention to us to it is wonderful for our faith. So thank you so much. And for people who want to find out more about you and your work, they can go to your website, francoserafini.it. is where he has a wonderful website with all his information. Thank you so much, Dr. Serafini, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Thank you. Thank you.
God bless.
And goodbye. Goodbye.
Goodbye. We need to take a short break, but when I come back, we're going to be trying to answer the question of the week. A woman writes in saying, I'm not religious, but I received a vision of Jesus. What do I do next? Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And people can go to my website, miraclehunter.com, click on the contact tab. If you're ever interested in inviting me to speak at your parish or event or conference, I do this and I give about a 45-minute talk. I do a book signing afterwards, but after the talk, people have questions. And I love to hear what people are thinking about when it comes to miracles. It's pretty fascinating. Everybody's thinking about miracles in some way or another. So I got a very interesting email to my email inbox at miraclehunter.com. You go to the website there and you click contact, send me a message that way. And I got a message from North Carolina. It says, Dear Miracle Hunter, who do I contact when I had a moving sighting, but I am not religious? I live in North Carolina and saw three crosses and Jesus at a spring in South Carolina. Thank you, Lynn. Well, thanks, Lynn, for your email. That is such a great question. We always talk about these cases of people seeing visions of Mary, and almost everybody who sees a vision of Jesus or Mary is Catholic, strangely enough. So they just go to their local parish priest, and even if they were Christian, they would probably talk to their pastor about their experience, perhaps to their other Christian or Catholic friends. So what happens if you're not any of those things, and you still have a vision of Jesus or Mary? So it's a great question. So even though you're not Catholic, I would recommend, Lynn, that you look up a pastor at the local Catholic church or another one nearby and see if you might set up a meeting. And you might say something like, Father, I'm not Catholic, not even religious necessarily, but I had a faith experience. I'd like to talk to somebody about it. And maybe he'd agree to meet you or recommend a different priest. Of course, when you speak to people about miracles, because private revelation is not optional for Catholics, we can believe in the modern miracles, or we can ignore them safely. And so it's possible that a given priest may or may not be interested to talk about it. But it seems like, and you'll be met with caution and skepticism, I'm sure, initially. All the famous cases of Marian apparitions, Our Lady of Lourdes, or Guadalupe in Mexico, the bishop or the priest who hears the story says, I don't know, I don't believe it right away. So don't necessarily be discouraged by that. But I'd start with a meeting with the priest if you can get it. And if this experience has opened you up to potentially learning more about the Catholic faith, it's probably worth mentioning in that interview as well. So good luck with that. And thanks, Lynn, for your question. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter@EWTN, or just go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and just click on the contact tab. And maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary Project. Each week, we look at the Marian devotion of the day. For today's day, we've got the Mother of God from Zarovinci in Belarus in the 14th century. And the story goes that one night around the year 1500, some herders noticed a wild pear tree radiating light from a small jasper oval carving of a woman and child in Eleusa, tenderness-style icon, and the Slavonic inscription of the Magnificat in the Orthodox liturgy, quote, "More honorable than the cherubim, and more glorious beyond compare than the seraphim. In virginity you bore the word of God, the word God, true God, Mother of God, we magnify you," end quote. The herders took it to the landlord, Alexander Sultan, who put it in a chest, but it reappeared in the forest, and Sultan built a wooden church there that burned down later. And some children passing the spot saw a radiant woman holding the stone icon. When a priest came, she had vanished, and the icon remained on that rock where she sat. And that is today's devotion to the Mother of God, Zarovinci, from Belarus in the 14th century. For more information on this fascinating devotion, or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to 365dayswithmary.com, pick up the book, go to the website, or you can download the free iOS app, 365 Days with Mary. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We always look at the sainthood news, those people who are coming down the pipeline, those people who will be saints someday, to keep you up to date on what the Catholic Church is doing related to saints. And so we had some very interesting news this week where it says, not since the 5th century, Catholic and Coptic churches will share saints. And it was reported that the 20 people put in orange jumpsuits lined up at the beach and were killed by ISIS are now inscribed not only in the Coptic Book of Saints, but also in Roman martyrology. 21 Christian martyrs, including 20 Copts, killed by Daesh in 2015 in Libya, will be included in the Roman martyrology. Pope Francis announced this on May 11th in front of Patriarch Tewodros II, the Pope of the Coptic Orthodox Church. So we have a meeting of two popes who was there in Rome. And this is historic. The Catholic Church and the Coptic Church have saints of the first centuries in common, but these will be the first saints recognized by both churches since the split of the 5th century. And so that's an interesting move that Pope Francis made. And we have the relics that the Coptic Pope offered to the successor of Peter in a glass and wood box. They come from the church dedicated to the 21 martyrs erected in 2018 in their home village of Al-Aur. Now let's check out the Might Be Saint of the Day. We do this every week where we talk about the people on the path to sainthood. Those are servants of God, venerables, and blesseds before they have all their miracles and they're declared a saint by the church. And so for today's day, we've got Blessed Maria Angelica Perez from 1897 to 1932 from Argentina. She was born on August 17th, 1897 in San Martin in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and to immigrants from Spain, and she was raised in a farm family, and she was known as a pious girl. And she entered the Daughters of Our Lady of the Garden on December 31st, 1915, taking her vows on September 7th, 1918. She was a teacher and a catechist to many children. And from 1924 to 28, she was assigned to a tuberculosis hospital where she worked closely with sick children. When her own health began to suffer, she was assigned to a hospital in Villanar in Chile, where she was a source of joy, comfort, and teaching, the teaching to many patients. And she died on May 20th, 1932, of natural causes, and her body is incorrupt. It was found in 1968 to be in that state and later reinterred in a chapel there in Argentina. She was declared venerable in 2004 by Pope John Paul II, and on November 2012, she was recognized as blessed by Cardinal Angelo Amato, the prefect of the Congregation for the Causes of Saints. And in her miracle that was used was a healing from tuberculosis. And so if she gets one more miracle, she will be declared a saint. Find out more about any of the future saints if you go to theymightbesaints.com or check out my EWTN television show, which airs on Fridays at 4 p.m. Central Time. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Gary Solomon, producer, director, and writer of the brand new film Nefarious. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We talk a little bit on this program about things that perhaps are on the opposite side of inspiring, in the sense that we always talk about these cases of miracles, Marian apparitions, Eucharistic miracles, the miracles of the saints, those things that shine the light on the faithful. Of course, there is the other side, the darker side of things that they still remind us of God's presence in a backwards kind of way. There's a brand new film that's out. It's called Nefarious, and the producer, director, and writer of that program is here with us today. His name is Cary Solomon. He is known for his work in the movies Unplanned, God's Not Dead, and Do You Believe? Welcome to the program today, Cary Solomon.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us to talk about this this fascinating new film. We'll start right out the gate. What inspired you to shine your light on something as nefarious as the subject matter of this one?
I think that the time we live in, it's obvious. I mean, I would ask any of your listeners, when they walk out the door of their house every morning now, is everything normal like they're used to, like 5 years ago or 10 or 20 years ago? Does it feel the same way? And I would say resoundingly no, because the bottom line is that evil is spreading, and it's aggressive. And it's out. It's not hiding. What we wanted to do this movie for was that, well, first of all, the Lord prompted us to do the movie. He guided us into the movie. He wrote the movie. I mean, he used us as his tool, obviously, but, you know, I feel it was timing. The Lord has perfect timing. And I believe due to the darkness that's arising, this movie drags the devil out of the darkness and into the light and shows his machinations. And so we were highly motivated to do it, because we believe that one of the real problems that Catholicism especially has is people have kind of fallen into this kind of lukewarm understanding of the devil. Yeah. Like, well, you know, I'm not sure if he exists or not. This movie will convince people that he exists and that he is just plain out evil. And it's not God that's oppressing people or hurting people. It's the devil.
That's right. Now, you've talked about this film as a supernatural thriller, and there's various ways, perhaps, that people have kind of opened themselves up to this dark side. Ouija boards, tarot cards, Reiki. Some people say even yoga or tattoos can put people in the wrong mindset. What do you think these activities have to do with people getting infested with the demonic?
I believe there's no discussion. I mean, it's an absolute fact. When a person goes tattooing their body, first of all, in the Bible it says do not do that. That's number one. Number two, yoga. You're offering and chanting to foreign gods and getting into positions of these demonic gods from ancient times. I mean, there's Reiki, is a window, Ouija board, everything you're talking about. But what about movies, horror movies? When you go to a horror movie, I'm confounded that people, even Catholics, would go to these movies. They're being demonically infested in the movie. I mean, if I was the devil, I'd be laughing. I mean, literally, people are serving themselves up. And what we wanted to do, it is a supernatural thriller, a psychological thriller. But I want to assure your audience, there is no demonics, there is no satanics, there's no bad language, there's no gratuitous sex, there's no scares in the movie. The movie is two men talking over a table. One of them says he's possessed. The other doesn't believe in God. And I will tell you, it's never boring. It's like C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters meet Silence of the Lambs. So if you remember when Jodie Foster spoke to Anthony Hopkins,
yes,
this is what that movie is like.
Fascinating. We're talking today with Kerry Solomon, the producer, director, and writer of the brand new film Nefarious. And so one of the things I think that's so interesting in filmmaking or any kind of a project, perhaps, and things get derailed a little bit. I know they talked about this in The Passion of the Christ and other films where some unusual problems happened in the making of the film. Did you run into anything that like that in your set?
Oh, my goodness. I would say to your listeners, if you don't believe in the existence of the devil, declare war against him and see what happens. And you'll find out very quickly, very, very quickly, that the devil is not only real, but that he is active. We have had an immense amount of demonic manifestation. Every electronic device, every cell phone, it never works. It can't wait. You know, every time it's needed, emails getting lost. The roof to my building in Burbank ripped off where I was doing my marketing and my team was. We had to scatter because of the buildings just being destroyed. 8 car crashes in the first 11 days on set shooting. All the cars are totaled. But here's what's interesting. In all the accidents, in all the things that were bad that happened, not once did anyone get hurt. So the devil attacks and tries to thwart, but the Lord holds, stands up and pushes back and will not allow that to happen. For example, we had a press junket. Father Carlos Martins, who's a renowned exorcist, probably the number one exorcist or number two exorcist in the United States. He has a podcast called The Exorcist Files. He basically was at the press junket. Well, we're shooting the press interviews, and as we're shooting, there are sounds coming out of the couch. The light in the room is flicking on and off. The sound mixer and the cameras aren't working. All of a sudden, the discs get corrupted, just this kind of thing. So we call up Father, and I said, I think we might have a problem here. He walks in the room, I mean, just like in a movie scene, he walks in the room and it's totally, first thing he says is, I know exactly what's going on. And basically, he walks across the room, puts his back to the window, which we're 5 stories up now. He takes out his holy water that he made and that he basically starts reading a exorcism prayer against the demonic in Latin. And basically, behind his right ear, there's a female voice chanting and trying to distract him, a demonic voice. And so he goes through the prayer. He gets to the part in the prayer where he says, behold now the mighty and terrible name of Jesus Christ. And the voice behind him disappears. The noises and voices out of the couch disappear. The light stops flicking on and off and everything goes back to work. I mean, you're dealing with something that is not make-believe. And people, I find it ironic, and by the way, this is a constant thing. I had a exorcist on set, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with us. You know, we obviously don't work the Sabbath, but he was there all the time. His appendix exploded, literally. They said if we didn't get him to the hospital by the time we got him there, he would have died. So we were on a constant attack, constant attack, and it continues to this day. My producer, 3 days ago, because we're still working on the movie, is putting his kid in the back seat of his car, and he leans in, an SUV hits the door leaning up against him at 45 miles an hour and rips the car to pieces.
Oof.
His wife, his 2 kids, and him. He's left standing there, totally unharmed again, unharmed, which is impossible. The day, 2 days later, my marketing guy gets out of his car, wham, a car hits his car, destroying his car. My broker, booker who books the theaters, basically, most important day is the next day. He's on a flight back from the press junket. His ear explodes on the airplane, his eardrum. So what do we know? We know that the devil does not want, he does not want this kind of thing out in the world. The greatest statistic, however, and I know I've gone on a little bit here, but I really think it's important that people understand that this is real, is that when I put out Unplanned, we had piracy on the level of 40 million views were stolen, between 10 and 40 million. It happens the instant you put a movie out. Now, this is a mathematical, and there are thousands of people that are stealing on the internet, tens of thousands, probably millions. On this movie, We've been out almost over six weeks. We have not had one act of piracy. Now, you're saying, why is that? Why is that a miracle? Because the devil does not want this movie to be seen. So what happens is all those people that are stealing somehow, and by the way, it's a mathematical impossibility.
Right.
That's like saying to the internet, no one is sending email today, and it's not going to be a technical malfunction. I just don't want you to. And I'm not saying he's in communication with them, but he basically, that's how powerful the devil is. The devil is an adversary we should respect. He's the enemy of mankind.
Absolutely. So if you're not going to steal the movie, how's the best way for people to check this one out?
You can go to whoisnefarious.com. You can go to Fandango. You can go to any of the ticket buying sites. You can go to any theater and ask. I mean, it's the same way, basically. And eventually, obviously, it'll come out on, you know, video on demand and stuff like that.
Wonderful. And for Catholics who are going to see this movie, what are they going to walk away with?
They're going to be enlightened. They're not going to be scared. I would say to you, don't judge the poster as the movie. This is not a demonic horror movie. We did that poster to bring in people who need to see the movie. It was designed to bring in young kids because they're attracted to the demonic. But once we get them in the theater, we show them truth. What they will be is they will be enlightened that there is good and evil, there is a God, and there is a devil. I'll tell you quickly. I have a situation. I have a woman that I know. Her name is Carol. She worked on the movie with us. A friend of hers got out of confession. She was going to confession, and he walks over to her and says, you know what the priest just gave me as penance? To go see Nefarious. So we have priests giving this as penance. Cardinal Burke, by the way, recommended and endorsed the movie, and me and Chuck and our work on the movie. So we have the church saying that this is good work. This is good fruit.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Cary Solomon, producer, director, and writer of this brand new film, Nefarious. Check this one out. Thanks so much, Cary, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you, Michael.
That was Cary Solomon talking to us about the new film, Nefarious. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Dr. Franco Serafini, the author of A Cardiologist Examines Jesus, talking about Eucharistic miracles, and Cary Solomon, producer, director, and writer of the brand new film, Nefarious. Check out my show, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, airing on EWTN on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tonight's show is on Trey Fontana, the miraculous encounter at a site where St. Paul was martyred, the Virgin of Revelation's appearance to Bruno Carnacchiola, a rabid anti-Catholic, changed both the man and the church itself. And check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Church Investigates the Supernatural, from Pan Books and available from EWTNRC.com. And I'd like to thank you today for joining me on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions, the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.